For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you, Taigen, and thank you for really giving all of us consistently opportunities to serve and create this this community and this experience together. And it really is an example of some of what I'm going to be talking about today. So thank you. My subject today is on some of the origins of Western Zen, and in particular ways in which a certain characteristic of those origins that continues to this day, even in our Sangha, especially in our Sangha. And I'm not a historian, and I'm not an authorized teacher, and I've in some ways I feel very inadequate to speak about some of these things, but so I speak to you as one student to another who's done a little reading and some years of practice. So beginning, taking a little historical bird's eye view, back in Japan in 1868, the Meiji period marked an opening to the West for the first time in many centuries. And one small thing that happened during that opening was a school called the Keio Gijuku School, and it was a school for Western knowledge and science, and it was a school that also carried some criticism of traditional Japanese Eastern values, and they were caught up in some of the excitement about the West. And I'll come back to that in a minute. In the West, at the same time, in the 19th century, after so much colonialism around the world and world trade that was happening, there was a new kind of optimism about a universal relationship between nations and cultures, and it was pretty naive in some ways and still pretty exploitative, but there was an optimism about a kind of universal world order, universal industry and trade, universal peace, universal religions, even universal language. Esperanto came into existence at that time, and so there was this openness to the West, and so both were open to each other in the late 1800s. And in this spirit came the first, what I think of as the first wave of Zen pioneers from Japan to the United States. And then eventually to Europe as well. And this was a remarkable thing that happened around 1905, 1906, mostly through one teacher and his descendants or students themselves, who really began it. And that was Soyin Shaku. And he had first come to the United States to Chicago at the World Parliament of Religions, or World Parliament of Religions at the Columbia Exposition in 1893, the big World's Fair. And it was this huge Parliament of Religions with representatives from all over the world that they brought in. There were some curious, open-minded Americans. Among them was Paul, is it Karus, you say? How do you say Paul?
I think Karus.
Karus, Paul Karus from Chicago, who was enthusiastic and had invited Soyin Shaku, partly because Soyin Shaku was a student at the Keio Gijuku School that I mentioned earlier. It was really excited about some of the Western possibilities. And so he came and spoke, and he brought with him his translator, a young monk that he had worked with in Japan, D.T. Suzuki, who became one of the foremost Western scholars to introduce Buddhism to the West over many years following. D.T. Suzuki eventually developed a relationship with Paul Karas and the Open Court Press, and Karas invited him to live with him in a suburb outside of Chicago and do some translating for their new Eastern Religions series, which he did. And while he was there, he wrote his first book, Outlines of Mahayana Buddhism. The some of the spirit of what you catch in Soyin Shaku's book, first book, and then D.T. Suzuki's first book, was that they were really trying to communicate this Buddhism thing to a West that had absolutely no clue about it. And they were trying to say something about the essence of it, and to, at the same time, almost make it palatable by helping Westerners relate to it through Western eyes, and especially through Christianity. And so Soyin Shaku, his first book was titled Sermons of a Buddhist Abbot, Sermons, or Zen for Americans, as it became known. And the first chapter was the God conception of Buddhism. And it's really interesting to start that way for a Zen teacher. You know, I mean, that's pretty unusual. But he felt compelled that he needed to address that question right up front with Westerners, who inevitably would ask that right away. If this is a religion, well, what about God? And it does so in some interesting ways. He and D.T. Suzuki both relied a lot on Dharmakaya to try to make some kind of bridge between the two approaches, and yet they ended up being very different, of course. D.T. Suzuki's first book it does the same thing in the first chapters of Outlines of Mahayana Buddhism. A third person who was related to Soyin Shaku, among others, was Nyogen Senzaki. Nyogen Senzaki, I'll tell you more about him later, but he ended up staying. D.T. Suzuki came and went and had a period of residency in New York, especially when he taught at Columbia University, but a few of them stayed, and a number of them went back to Japan. Soyin Shaku went back to Japan. But his own students, some of them stayed. One of them that did stay was Nyogen Senzaki. Another one was Tetsuo Shaku, who came in 1906, the same time that his teachers, Soyin Shaku, came back to the United States and lived for a while. Soyin Shaku came with D.T. Suzuki and Nyogen Senzaki, the three of them, to the San Francisco area. And at the invitation of some wealthy family, the Russell family, lived with them for some time and taught them Zazen and had a daily practice, almost a little monastic family practice, in their home, and gave lectures, and friends came in, and then some of them began to teach elsewhere in California, especially to Japanese communities, but also to Americans who are interested. And Nyogen Senzaki was brought in as one of the students, as was D.T. Suzuki, into this household, and was given the role of houseboy, which a lot of Asian young men were doing for wealthy families in the Bay Area and elsewhere. And eventually he was fired, we don't really know why, and sort of set loose in a very friendly way by his teacher who remained. And so he was alone, didn't know much English, and Nyogen Senzaki ended up sort of seeing himself as a wandering pilgrim in a strange land. And he stayed, but he always felt like, you know, sort of, here I am, you know, life has landed me here in America, and I want to make something out of it that opens up the Dharma for the West and maybe even influences the Dharma from a Western point of view. So Tetsuo Shaku, I mentioned earlier, was one of the students of Soyin Shaku who came, who ran in Japan a center called Ryobo Kai, which was a very unusual center for lay practice. And this gets to one of the themes I want to touch on here. It was a center for lay practice outside Tokyo that included lay Dharma transmission. And it was the emphasis was the Dharma and the practice of Zen for lay people living in the world and having families and having jobs and so forth. And he wanted to bring that to America. So he thought, I'll start a center like that. And he brought 14 students with him. This was in 1906 to the Bay Area. Nothing is mentioned of the great earthquake and fire, which was of a magnitude of the Chicago fire in San Francisco, and these people were arriving, and I often wonder, what was that like for them? I mean, so anyway, they arrived, they were in Hayward, outside of, across the East Bay, and established a little farm and a place for lay practice. It didn't last long. They moved it to San Francisco, and that didn't last too long. Most of the monks went back to Japan, except for Nyogen Senzaki, who stayed. And he began working odd jobs, ended up after San Francisco going to Los Angeles, getting jobs in the hotel business. And he stayed in the hotel business for the rest of his life, really, and considered his Zendo to be a floating Zendo, because at first it met in people's homes. And then gradually it developed a little community and a place, and he lived nearby. And so he developed a way of approaching Zen, which was primarily oriented for lay people living in their own homes and having jobs and families and that sort of thing. And he, in some ways, he related himself to Bodhidharma coming east. And he came east, too, to what we call the West, and saw that it was possible maybe to develop the practice and the Dharma in a new land that was not bound by so much of the tradition of the East and of Japan in particular, because that was, as I said earlier, part of the thinking of the time. One of his poems here in this wonderful book, Like a Dream, Like a Fantasy, this captures some of the spirit of Nyogen Senzaki over those years. And at this point, he's been here for 35 years. What have I done in this strange land? Nothing could I do without my teacher, and that's Soyen Shaku. I've lived almost in vain while the teaching itself joined to the revival of American spirit. Praise be to the power of the wisdom of enlightenment. This saying, while the teaching itself, the Dharma, joined to the revival of American spirit, he was sensing a revival of American spirit and at the same time a revival of Zen Buddhism through that. And they were very excited about what America might bring to the Dharma as they entered into this land and attempted to emphasize lay practice. They were all, in one way or another, a bit disillusioned with these first pioneers, and even the later ones, with their perception of Japanese Zen that had become institutionalized and superficial, and really the practice was pretty much limited to monasteries, and lay people were not gaining the benefit of Zen practice in Japan, and they thought maybe in America. And so they came with that spirit. Another one of Soyen Shaku's students was Soke An Sasaki, who came also in 1906 and was involved in Ryobo Kai, that place in Hayward, California. But then when that closed up, he stayed too. And he wandered around the West, especially up into the Northwest, and worked odd jobs, and eventually settled in New York City, where he started with friends there, the New York Buddhist Society of America. And this was, I think, in the 30s, early 30s, where he kind of connected up with Bohemians in Greenwich Village, and they were very interested in what he was doing. He, as well as Nyogen Senzaki and some others, Japanese, who were here during World War II, were interned in the internment camps. While Soke An Sasaki was in the internment camp that he was sent to, one of the laywomen in the New York City Sangha there that he had established helped him get out with the help of a lawyer, and she was the widow of a very rich man who had died some years ago named Fuller. Her name was Ruth Fuller Everett. And she was of the Fuller family, rather. To see how this is all intertwined in early Buddhism in the United States, her daughter had married Alan Watts. And so she got connected with Soke An Sasaki, the teacher in New York City. The first Zen teacher in New York City was settled there, and got him out of the internment camp. And they got married. Soke An Sasaki died shortly afterwards. They had a short marriage, but Ruth Fuller Everett Sasaki went to Japan and began working very diligently with translations and translators, and people like Gary Snyder and others hooked up with her in Japan and worked with her in some of the translations. So this is in the 30s, and very shortly, and so you have Nyogen Senzaki on the West Coast and Soke An Sasaki on the East Coast, and then World War II hits, and people go into internment camps, and things died down in terms of any enthusiasm about anything Japanese in this country. But after the Second World War, in the late 50s, the beatniks arise, and then the hippies arise, and again, enthusiasm for the East, and a second wave of what I think of as Zen missionaries came to the United States in the 50s and 60s. And these names you may be more familiar with. Taizen Maizumi in Los Angeles, who established a center there that was flourishing over time. Shunryu Suzuki in San Francisco, and others that came with him. Edo Shimano, first to Hawaii and then New York City. Joshu Sasaki in Los Angeles, Dainin Katagiri first to San Francisco and then Minnesota. And after these and a few others in the 60s that came and really took off with lay practice among first beatniks and then hippies, at least people who were excited about things Eastern and meditation and so forth, it flourished. And Zen in America became what it is today, which is hundreds of centers all over the country, but with this characteristic of an emphasis on lay practice. And people like you and me, who are working and living in the world and having families and so forth, and coming to a place like Ancient Dragon and learning the Dharma and learning the practice and establishing a Sangha together that is rooted in our daily life as it is in the world. Now, many of these teachers also establish monastic training centers like Tassajara and the one up in the Catskills that's associated with the New York Sangha there and others. But really the norm has been lay practice in centers like this. And that is not new to Buddhism, but I think its emphasis is unique. There have been times when even people like Dogen emphasized lay practice and welcomed lay people, but there was always a heavy emphasis on monastic practice in the East, and in the West it flipped, where you have a heavy emphasis on practice like we have here, and less so in the monastic settings, but it's still there. So it's a really a flipping of what is emphasized. One of the things I love about these early missionaries, both in the early 1800s and also early 1900s and also the 60s, and I keep going back to their books to read them, is their voice. There is something about their voice that is very striking to me and appealing, and it has to do with, it's kind of a, you know, it's their second language. They're not so Americanized with a lot of psychology and contemporary spirituality, and they tend to have a view that is very traditional, but at the same time excited about it developing into the West in a new way. They have a passion about sharing the essence of the Dharma in a new land and try to make sure it gets across to all these interested people. And a kind of optimism that they saw was part of the character of America, too. It's an optimistic country, they said. And so one example of this voice that you hear from the first one, Soyon Shaku, is a poem that he wrote on his way here in, I guess it was 1893. It might have been 1906 when he came back. Leaving Japan for America, sea stretches out into sea, mountains into mountains. Where is the center of water? Where is the destination of clouds? I do not know. My heart tells me there is a happy field in the American land. I presume myself to be a follower of old Columbus. So they saw the West as an opportunity to revitalize Zen, as well as to influence American Western culture with Zen. And it's a kind of a beginner's mind attitude about it. So what is it? Let me just say a few words about what is it actually to do what they were excited about and what really took off in this country? What is it to practice in one's daily life, in the kind of life that most of us live with jobs and homes and sometimes families, and the kind of concerns that come with all those things? you could describe it in a lot of ways, and your experience of that is going to be probably verbalized differently than mine. But one of the things I can say about my experience with that, after practicing for some years with it, is that sometimes spiritual practice, and in this case Zazen, can be seen as kind of like we do physical exercise when we live a busy life in the world. That we do this thing in the morning and on Sundays if we come here, or Monday night, and sometimes for a full day or longer. We do this thing like going to the gym. Get up in the morning, go into our room, we have an altar maybe, we do this thing for a half an hour, whatever we do, and it's sort of like going to the gym. It tones us mentally, spiritually, maybe even physically, for our secular activities for the rest of the day. And it has a benefit, because we're better for actually having sat. And many times we'll say, you know, I haven't sat in a week, and I feel terrible. I really notice it in my daily life. And that we'd say the same thing about exercise. Well, that's good, and there's benefit there, but it can be a very dualistic way of looking at this, that there's this practice and then there's life. Another way is to see Zazen as one especially concentrated way of learning to be present and working with what is, and doing that in the simplicity of that little workshop that is sitting still, so that we can then do the same to some degree in the more diffused and complicated hours of the rest of our day, so that we bring that Zazen into practice, so that whether there are things that we like to think of as positive, you know, tasting our food, the kinds of things that Thich Nhat Hanh really emphasizes, staying awake to our surrounding environment, hearing sounds, the uniqueness of the stranger in front of us, all those things we think of as good, we can be more attentive to and practice with, almost like Zazen, really being in the moment as it is. But also bringing some of that spirit of Zazen into those moments that we think of as negative. Stress, work that we have to do but don't want to do, being bored, being in pain, having illness, being disappointed, hearing about some disturbing political crap, taking care of difficult people. In both these so-called positive and negative experiences, if we bring our Zazen practice directly to it in the moment, for me, something happens. It's still there. It's still maybe annoying or pleasant or whatever, but something happens in terms of an opening where there is more than just what's taking place in the moment, where there's more than just my reaction to it, where it has an energy that is life itself. And to me, that's just as challenging as being a monk. And I've hung around monasteries to know a little bit of what that might be like. Some of you have had practice periods in lengthy times in monasteries, so you may disagree with me, but there is something about the daily practice of Zazen in our daily life that is not better than a monastic practice, but is equally challenging if we look at it as Dharma gates are boundless. I really vow to try to enter them all day long. So that's some of the spirit that I think some of these early pioneers and missionaries from Japan came with in the hope of. And I believe we're trying to carry that forward even now. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Brian. I want to add some.
Please do.
Footnotes.
Yeah.
To me, yoga and Senzaki is extremely important. He's quoting Zendo. I think they sat like in chairs in rows. They didn't have cushions like we do. But he had groups up and down the West Coast. Mm-hmm. They traveled around and did various odd jobs. And then was in the internment camps, as you mentioned, during World War II. So you have there's a few books, I think, of his poetry about him. He's really inspiring for you.
Yeah.
Very humble and trying to make Zazen available. So he was, in some ways, with all due respects to Soen Chapo and D.T. Suzuki, the first Japanese teacher of practice, and that's what he emphasized.
Right, right.
Also, Soke An, he founded what's now the first Japanese institute, which is still there in downtown New York City, and a number of good practitioners continue there, some inside practice, but a really fine place, a small place. And Ruth Fuller Shizaki is also very important. When she went to Japan, she was resident in one of the sub-temples of Daitokuji. I saw them, which I visited. There's still Zazen that Westerners can go to in that place, and I saw the rocking chair on the veranda where she passed away. But she did her translation work, which is very important. She worked with Gary Snyder, but also Philip Yampolsky, who translated the Platform Sutra, and also Yanagita Seizan, a Japanese scholar who really inspired the first wave of Buddhology, Buddhist scholarship in America. So those early Japanese, you mentioned that the later people like Izumi Roshi, Kanemaru Roshi, Suzuki Roshi, and still Shohaku Okumura, who was moving to, in various ways left Japan because Shohaku didn't want to spend all his time doing memorial services, which is most of what Japanese priests, Sotoku priests do. So he came to teach us and translate Dokken. And I just want to mention my first teacher, who nobody ever heard of, but Reverend Kondo Nakajima, was a Soto Zen priest and trained at Sojiji. So I started with him in January 1975, and he totally inspired me. I've been seeing him doing Sukhumi since, and we're talking about Dogen. His English was worse than Kanemaru Roshi's, if you've heard that. His English was never very good, but it was very much more like this place than like a place like the city center in Roche. So I was with him. He had his apartment upstairs with his family, and two rooms with it. There was Zazen in the evenings, and Dosan once a week, and he had a Zazen instruction once a week. He had monthly organizations. So even though I spent many years living in Tassajara and being involved in the city center and doing practice period in Japan too, I never really wanted to teach in that monastic way. It can be very valuable, and going and doing a residential practice period for some people can be very important, but as you described, are being in the world and trying to respond to the world and having it informed by Zazen, that's something that I got from Nakajima Sensei after many years of doing residential practice. That's what I wanted to do in Chicago and New York. So anyway, I just wanted to say all that, and I appreciate what you said about residential practice. I don't know that, about non-residential practice, what we're doing here, I think both can be important.
Right.
For different people. So anyway, I just wanted to add on that. And,
Is anything about either the history or your experience of practicing, bringing Zazen into your daily life as a lay practitioner, anything at all about those things?
One of the things I notice is when I do sit every day, it's much easier to keep that sense of presence and that sense of being aware and throughout the day in the regular course of my life, and to bring that sense of sometimes I forget that, and when I remember, it encourages me to sit every day. Because it does make a difference. It's almost like you, in some senses, and I know you said, you know, it sort of splits it in the general. When you sit every day, you develop that sort of muscular sense of spirituality that you carry through. And it's sort of inspiring to hear you put that in this term. That helps you remember why you sit.
Right.
Comments or responses or questions?
So I have two different questions or comments. First one, I'll say that I think daily practice also helps an individual become more aware of the textures in their environment. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I think I become more aware of all the different sounds, all the different feelings in my body, more intuitive to the emotional energy around me. So I think that's so gradual, kind of what Jerry was saying too. It's so subtle that a person doesn't realize they become more acute sensory-wise than other people. Because you don't realize it, but it happens. And the second part is more historical. So this is either for you, Brian, or for you, Tyvin. Can you comment, like as you were researching it from your experience, how the Japanese masters who came here, how their influence then influenced the practice in Japan? How their experience here influenced what happened in Japan?
Yeah, I'll defer to you on that one.
Well, that's a difficult question. Now, there's still a great import in terms of Japanese Buddhists and institutions. It's still very much hierarchical institutions, and resident monastic practice is still the core. And yet, when I was in doing practice period in Japan, and when I was living in Kyoto, there were zazenkais, which is to say, gatherings of for an afternoon or evening or a day of lay people sitting together. So I witnessed that. And there's a lay lineage in Kyoto. So there is some more lay practice. I think there always was, but the core was master. In terms of American Zen now, still the residential monastic centers, there's numbers of them around the country, are important in terms of authorizing teachers and things like that. But as Brian says, there are many small, just sitting groups, or often not with a temple space like we have, as modest as it is, but it's people sitting houses. But in Japan, you know, there's still a lot of tension between Japanese and American Zen, and those of us who are American Zen teachers who have connections with Japan and practice in Japan, are involved in trying to be connected. Daigaku Umei was here recently. He's practiced for many years in the monastery in Japan. He's one of the people who's appeared to that. Shohaku was also. It's hard to say, but I think one of the things that's happening in modern Japanese Zen and Buddhism is a number of the teachers are trying to find modern ways of expressing things. So there's some teacher who does math. So there are Japanese Buddhist, Zen and other Buddhist people who are working at being more available to modern people, to lay people. But in some ways, they're more and more interested in what's happening in America. But it's still very puzzling to them. So anyway, it's complicated.
I know a layperson could go to the temple for service, correct?
In Japan?
Yes.
Some temples, not monastic training centers necessarily, okay. But sometimes, yeah.
So does that mean a layperson could go to a temple to sit?
Some places.
Okay.
That does exist.
But it's kind of rare, and you might only have one or two people, right?
Or maybe sometimes more.
Yeah.
It's not totally. Unusual, but it's not the main stream of what lay people do in Buddhism off to Asia, which is to go to ceremonies, to go to memorial services. There's large ceremonies, so one of the branches of modern, of 20th century Japanese Soto emphasized performing ceremonies. In a beautiful way, that's the next category of Buddhism. There's a range.
In some ways, as I've looked at this over the years and much longer experience in the Christian settings, I see some of it the way you've just described it and looking at that, is that in some ways the East is more like Christian churches in terms of the lay involvement. I mean, in the Christian churches, you'd have in a congregation people who would come to ceremonies to a church, but they probably don't do contemplative prayer at home. I mean, it might be, and they don't come all the time to some offering like that. You might have a contemplative prayer group with three people in it, which sounds a lot like what I've heard about Zen in Japan. And yet there have always been people who have been interested in going off to Christian monasteries and learning contemplative prayer and reading Thomas Merton and all that kind of stuff, just as I'm sure there always has been in the East with Buddhism. And so the thing that I wanted to point out was the flourishing in the last 60 years especially, which is a very short time in America, of an enthusiasm here that was brought by teachers and picked up by our culture here, or some in our culture, for a more involved lay practice where it's not primarily about just showing up for ceremonies. It's about learning to do Zazen in one's life and to live and study and be serious about it, but not be a monk. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For your time.
Yeah.
You know, just having spent the week in Tassajara, you know, it's interesting to think about, because I've been thinking, just kind of naturally thinking about some of these, what we're talking about. And I think about, like, the schedule, you know, at a place like Tassajara and how kind of nice that is to have such a strict schedule every day, to have sitting in the morning, that a whole group of you are going to every morning, and then services throughout the day that everybody's going to, sitting at night that everybody, you know, that kind of support. And then, you know, the lay practice in here, and not having a schedule like that, so the challenge of, kind of having to attend to your own practice every day, yourself. And also, you know, as you were suggesting in your talk, like bringing that practice into your everyday activities. There's, you know, in Tassajara or Green Gulch or maybe another monastery, and then you've just been to those two places, but it feels like the parts of your day kind of all kind of flow. Here, it's, you know, you're kind of making your own schedule. And I see the benefit of that, you know, that there's kind of, you're kind of having to constantly be awake to your everyday activities. It just feels so, it feels different, you know, I don't know that it should feel different, but
it's hard to establish, and sometimes it feels as if you don't have a lot of support for doing that.
And that's
one of the reasons we talk about it here, right?
Yeah, you're having to constantly pay attention to it. Which I think is good, but you're like literally living within like hundreds of feet of each other.
Sure. You
know? So, and I know people here come from all parts of the city, so. I don't know. I think about schedule a lot, and
right.
We kind of have to make our own schedule. But that's you're making it, and we're making this too.
Sure,
right now,
sure.
So. Just a brief comment on that. When I first practiced here in Tucson, our schedule is very full. There's just little gap, little spaces in the schedule when you're not supposed to be somewhere doing something. but on some level, I felt after a very short time like it was more my own time than I'd ever experienced.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I didn't have to think about what am I going to do next week, how do I fulfill that on my schedule. Just doing the next thing. It's very, it can be very good.
Just
doing
it. I feel like I'm not very familiar with what does it mean by monastic in the Japanese sect or Japanese schools. And you kind of mentioned this residential monastic training, and it almost sounds like it's kind of detached from the lay world. What I'm not familiar with. So the monks and nuns, they ordained as holy priests. So they go to the monastic sangha, but they actually get extremely busy. I've heard more than one monks and nuns say, I went into this life thinking I would get more time to sit, I actually have so much less time. They do all the administrative work, teaching, they do a lot of meditation retreats that are really well attended. Caring for members, doing financial, they become more busy than us having time to sit, actually. So of course they hold the 200-300 precepts from monastics hold that I'm more familiar with in that tradition. So celibacy, no marriage, no family. So I'm curious how, when you talk about the Japanese
Well, it's different in Japan than in the United States, because Japanese priests, monks who go into training monastery, they are do remain celibate. They're not. It's necessary, right? So it's more like what you described, and they're very fully involved. But I think that in terms of the training, the newer priests do lots of meditation. But then, as you have responsibilities for the monastery, it's more like what you just said. In the West, the Japanese Buddhism, actually all of Japanese Buddhism, there's no celibacy. In the West, in places like Tassajara or Greenwich, for example, there are couples. There are both ordained priests and lay people who are residents who follow the full schedule. Sometimes they work, working jobs outside. Some Japanese priests, when they're taking care of temples, so part of the point of monasticism, I think, in Buddhism, in Japan and the States, is you go in, you don't go in for life. You go to do a practice period, or you go for a few years, so Japanese priests have, then you go to have, in Japan, they have many temples in towns where they need priests, and those priests often are married and may have jobs, regular jobs, as well as so there's a range of different things. Here in the West, residential communities like the Greenwich, Tassajara, or Great Valley in Oregon, and many others. There's just a range of how people practice there. And there are many non-priest lay people who have businesses, they do have families, who are working full-time in that place. So, it's a range of different possibilities. But then for priests here, for example, or in other places like this, non-residential places, priests do have families, or may have families, and may have other jobs, and so forth. So there's a range of things.
Thank you. tradition. The tradition of Kinpo is just one. So, is there a difference between monk and priest?
These are English words. Those words come from Catholicism.
Yeah.
So we don't have English words for what Paul and I are. But we use the word priest because we're a priest ordained. We're not monks. Monk is more of, I think it is a functional term. So Michael Soder, who's a regular practitioner, is in the monastery and will stay for the practice period. So in a sense, he's doing monk practice, even though he's not a priest ordained. So I don't know if that helps or makes it more confusing. But there's no separate monk or priesthood. Monk, the same holy ordination that Paul does for what we call monks or priests. But the word monk is misleading in terms of the Western context. So I understand the confusion.
We should probably end. I just want to say one last word, and that is that I felt, as I looked into some of this history and thought about some of what I've been sharing with you, I really found myself encouraged and challenged, and I hope you do too, in the sense that, these pioneers and then later the builders, people I think of as builders in the 60s, I mean, the builders were only 60 years ago, and this is new. What we are doing is new, and it's not like brand new in Buddhism, but there's something new about it. And I think it's wonderful that, in some sense, you and I get to be in this time of history of Buddhism and be able to participate in building something worthwhile. So I encourage you.